Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. In just a few minutes, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh and Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran will be here to answer your questions. But we're going to start today with a conversation about pollinators. Approximately 90% of wildflowering plants and about 75% of food crops around the world depend on pollination for successful seed and fruit production. And as we all know, pollinators are struggling, facing all kinds of threats. Randall Cass is here today. He's an entomologist with Iowa State University Extension. He is an expert on honeybees, native bees, and other pollinators. Randall, welcome to the show.
Hi, Charity. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. And we've been talking about the plight of pollinators now for well over a decade. Give me an idea of what we know right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, over a decade ago was when you started hearing about bees dying or bee decline. People were calling it colony collapse disorder. And what we understand that to be now, the general consensus in the scientific community, is that we're seeing bee decline, and it's continuing to decline. And it's likely the result of multiple stressors acting synergistically for bees and for pollinators. So these stressors include things like, of course, insecticide exposure in our agricultural lands, but also poor forage availability. As we urbanize or as we till up land, there's less habitat for bees. And then finally, pests and pathogens. So different diseases or pests that can affect our hives. Those three things kind of work together to just create sort of a perfect storm that creates a great challenge for bees and other pollinators.
Well, and the honeybees for a while were kind of getting all of the attention. But of course, native pollinators are struggling too. So what do we know about this situation specifically for native pollinators in Iowa?
Well, so yeah, native pollinators are getting hit pretty hard. Honeybees tend to be sort of the poster child for the pollinator movement, them and monarchs. But a lot of people don't realize that we actually have hundreds of native bees here in Iowa, hundreds of native bee species. And we are also seeing a decline in the abundance and diversity of those species. And unlike honeybees, which they're sort of semi-domesticated livestock, we have a little bit of control over our bee populations. If I'm a beekeeper and I lose half my hives over the winter, I can order new queens, I can start new colonies. But whenever we're talking about native species, we don't have as much control. It's something that we can't just order new species for the most part. So they're getting hit arguably even harder.
Well, and as you mentioned, the monarchs, of course, have gotten a lot of attention, and we all love monarchs.
Absolutely.
But not everybody loves the other native pollinators. Is that part of the problem, that these aren't necessarily insects that people have good feelings about?
It could be. You know, people are always wowed when I talk about the research I do with bees. And, you know, I say, oh, last summer I got over 300 stings. I just quit counting. People are afraid of stings. People are afraid of bees. And so that's one thing that I encounter quite a bit. I guess it's sometimes hard to root for something that could sting you. But for the most part, part of my work is conducting surveys. So whenever I give extension presentations, I talk to Iowans, specifically farmers, landowners, and beekeepers. And with my survey results, I'm seeing that whether you're a farmer, whether you're a landowner, everyone kind of across the board is saying, you know what, pollinator conservation and creating pollinator habitat is something that's important to me, which I was surprised by. It's something that people care about. Now it's a matter of talking to them about what tools they have that will work for them to do that.
All right, well, let's talk about homeowners and what individuals can do to create a more pollinator-friendly environment. How much control over this do you think I have if I live in the suburbs and have a pretty typical yard?
Right. Well, I'm sure everyone has seen bees in their backyard. I know I get calls sometimes of people, you know, they'll find a bumblebee nest that they accidentally ran over with the lawnmower, or maybe a bumblebee nest that was made inside their child's little plastic backyard house. So bees are in urban areas. And so that means that the more habitat that's available for them, the better. The majority of our native species of bee are solitary and ground nesting bees, or solitary and stem nesting bees. So ground nesting bees just need open land that's untilled, that's not being mowed, so that they can burrow in holes and make their nests. Stem nesting bees will often find their nests in sort of the dried out stems that are hollow, or sometimes in wood. So the best thing we can do is leave areas as pollinator habitat, and sometimes it's things we wouldn't think of, like dead plant stems. And then the other side of that would be planting for pollinators. So there are lists of different flowers that tend to attract beneficial insects. A lot of bees, a lot of native species tend to like native plants. And the other thing when you think about planting for pollinators, especially in Iowa, is planting things that are going to blossom throughout the year. So you want some early spring flowering plants, especially in the early spring when the bees are coming out and all they have to forage on is dandelions. But then you're also going to want things all the way through the summer and into the late fall.
Well, you mentioned native plants, and I guess I'm curious about that because, of course, we plant a lot of flowers. Not all of them are native. Many of them are not native. If we just have sort of a collection of flowers in our yard, does that support pollinators, or do we need to be more mindful than that?
That's a good question. I think that it can be a healthy mix of different things. I think that people should plant what they like and plant what they think is beautiful, but also keep in mind that there are certain flowers that bees that can sometimes be picky. There's certain flowers that they can tend to prefer. So there's a few lists that are out there on the internet that have ratings for how much bees like the flower and what time of year it's blooming. I encourage people to check out and maybe try to incorporate some of those things into their flower beds.
And before we started the show today, Mark Vitosh mentioned to me that the Department of Natural Resources also has a publication about native plants, native woody plants, many of them, that we can add to our environment to support pollinators. Since we've been talking about this, do you feel like progress is being made? I mean, we've seen a little bit of a resurgence in the last year in the monarch population, although, of course, it remains to be seen how significant that's going to be over time. Do you feel like you're getting traction on this message?
Yeah, I think that the first part, which is getting the message out, I think that's done. I think people are aware. People are interested in pollinator conservation. They're interested. You see Save the Bee bumper stickers out there. So there's a lot of public awareness. I think that what people need now is the tools to actually implement some things. Learn about what types of plants they can plant. Learn about, the fact that it's not just honeybees. There's also all sorts of native bee species that are solitary. They don't live in big colonies. They're not producing honey. And they need ground for nesting, and they need flowers to forage on as well. So I think that we're in like the next phase where people are looking for different things that they can actually do.
What's the focus of your research at Iowa State?
Yeah, so we are looking at honeybee health and native bee abundance in Iowa landscapes. Iowa can prove to be a somewhat challenging landscape for bees since 85% of the state is devoted to agriculture. And so that reduces, if our land is being planted in crops, that reduces the amount of land that's available to honeybees to forage on and for native bees to nest in. So what we're looking at specifically in our research is we're placing hives at agricultural sites, and then we're also placing them at prairie sites. The idea being that before Iowa was agricultural, it was mostly prairie. So a lot of these native species that were here then probably thrive well on those plants. So we look at our hives at the soybean sites, and we look at them at prairie sites, and we do hive inspections where we look at different key health indicators for the honeybees. So that includes hive mass, which tells us how much nectar and pollen they're collecting, because if you can get a real heavy hive, that means that your hive is really bustling, really bringing in a lot of nectar and making honey. We also look at hive populations. So we're out in the middle of the soybean field getting stung, trying to estimate the amount of bees that are on each frame. We look at brood laying patterns. So the queen lays eggs in the cell, and we call that brood, and they start to grow from egg, larvae, pupae. And so we monitor how many eggs the queen is laying. And then we also take samples back to the lab, and we look at instances of disease that could be in the bees, and we also check fat lipids to see how fat and healthy they are. And then using all those different indicators, we're able to compare the effect that the prairie site would have on the hives as opposed to the soybean site. And then there's other experiments going on as well that are looking specifically at the queen health, or looking at the Iowa State University Prairie Strips program, which incorporates small patches of prairie into agricultural fields.
What have you learned so far from looking at the prairie sites versus the soybean sites, for example?
Yeah, we see some differences. When the team first started the experiment, I think they were surprised to see how heavy the hives got in the soybean sites in the month of July. July is when soybean is flowering, and I think that common knowledge prior to that, or the assumption, was that honeybees wouldn't really be interested in soybean flowers. But actually what our research is showing is that, at least in Iowa, soybean is providing a good source of nectar in that time that it's flowering. On top of that, we also found a large abundance of different types of native species of bee in the soybean field as well. And I think prior to doing that research, people just assumed that the bees weren't interested in soybean at all. So that's been pretty interesting. In comparison to prairie, what we're finding is that in soybean, it's sort of a boom and then a bust. So during the month of July, when soybean is blooming, the hive gains a lot of mass because they're collecting a lot of nectar. But then at the end of July, once soybean is done blooming, we see a huge decline in hive mass. They're eating all their stores. Everything that they had stored from that month of July, they eat it all up, which puts them at a disadvantage going into the winter, come October, November, December. If they eat all their food stores, they don't have enough to survive the winter. In prairie, we see that they get a little bit of a buffer. They get a little bump up. They save some of those honey stores because there are more flowering plants in the prairie in that late summer, early fall season that's so crucial for honeybees.
We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I've been talking with Randall Cass. He's an entomologist with Iowa State University Extension. He's an expert on honeybees, native bees, and other pollinators. And, of course, you're welcome to join the conversation with your questions for Randall. We've also got Mark Vitosh from the Department of Natural Resources joining us, and Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. They are here to answer your questions as well. So give us a call, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. I've been talking with Randall Cass, an entomologist with Iowa State University Extension. We've been talking about pollinators and planting for pollinators. I also want to mention that Pollinator Fest is coming up at Ryman Gardens in Ames. That's on June 22nd. All kinds of educational activities, fun activities, and free admission to Ryman Gardens all day that day. I now want to say hello to Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here today. And Mark, did you want to plug any of your favorite native plants when you're thinking about pollinators?
Oak. You know, trees in general, and maybe Randall can talk about it a little bit, but they're kind of there. He mentioned, like, early in the spring, there's some different trees that can help with pollinators. And just related to oak, there's some research that's been out there in the Midwest that shows basically oak species can support about 534 species of butterflies and moths. And that's not just for pollination and stuff like that, but that's for actually eating the leaves and stuff like that. So there's support, and he also talked about nesting. There's a number of native bees that he mentioned that nest in dead trees or tree branches, or they're ground nesters in forest. So the forest is a very important component of that whole system too, I think. And there's a publication from the DNR called Iowa's Woodlands, Vital Habitat for Native Pollinators, that has some list of different tree species, talks about when they bloom, how they can support pollinators, how to create habitat and stuff associated with prairies and stuff like that, too.
All right. Let's dive into questions, and you are welcome to join us with yours at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's one from Carol in Cedar Rapids. She says, every year when I buy new flowering plants for my flower pots or garden, I worry that they've been doused in neonicotinoids, the insecticides. And instead of helping the pollinators, I'm luring bees and other insects to flowers and plants that may kill them. Is that a reasonable concern? And how long do neonicotinoids persist in the plants? Would it help to deadhead any flowers when the plants are first brought home? Randall, what are your thoughts about neonicotinoids?
Oh, yeah, that's funny. Because last year, maybe it was last summer, I showed up to my office and there was just a bag of dead bees on my desk, and someone had left me a post-it that said, found these on my new nursery plants. What do you think happened? So this is a question I've had before. I did a little bit of research and I found that there are that it is a common practice to use neonicotinoids in nurseries, but there are several nurseries out there that have pledged to stop using them, to not spray in their nurseries foliar sprays on their plants. So you can look online to see the different nurseries. Some of them are pretty big name ones, to see different nurseries that have pledged not to do that. I think it's a good concern to have, because especially if the plants have been recently sprayed, the neonicotinoids can be pretty persistent there on the plant for a while. And so you could be attracting bees, and it could be hurting the bees. Sometimes it might not even kill them. It could have a sublethal effect, you know, damaging them in some way, but not killing them.
Right, which could hurt them longer term as far as reproduction, et cetera, right?
Right.
So what's your approach? I mean, do you ask the nursery? Would they be able to answer that question?
Yeah, I would try asking the nursery. And then, like I said, there's a pledge that different companies signed on to that said that they wouldn't be spraying, doing foliar sprays of these types of insecticides on their plants before they sell them.
All right, so do your homework before you shop is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to just ask her last question, too. So there could be people listening right now thinking, uh-oh, I just brought home plants. I don't want these to be killing pollinators. If you cut the flowers off the plants when they're first brought home, do you think that that would make a difference? I mean, we don't necessarily know how long the neonicotinoids stick around, right?
Right. Well, if they're systemic, if it was on a seed treatment, which I doubt is the case. But yeah, if you are really concerned, I think you could. I think that would be a possible solution, especially if it was a perennial and you knew something was going to come back next year.
All right. This is a question from Patty. She says, my mason bee house has never been occupied since I hung it 2 years ago. Is it because I don't have enough to attract them nearby? What can I do?
So native bee nests, maybe people have seen them around. Sometimes they call them bee hotels. They can be made of just a block of wood that has holes drilled in it. Sometimes people will bundle bamboo or straws together because for stem nesting native species of bees, solitary stem nesting bees, which is about 30% of the native bees that are out there, they need stems like that to nest in. And, you know, sometimes you just get mixed results. You know, I've heard people say that they put the nest out, they put the box out, and it'll attract wasps instead of bees, and they wanted bees, not wasps. I hear some years that people just don't get any, and other years they get plenty. One thing I will say about those nests, though, is that I try to remind people that it's more of a conversation piece. The nests, they can provide some habitat for bees, but it's not... I want to discourage people from feeling like they have saved the bees now that they put the nest out there.
So it's more of a garden accessory.
Right. And it's a great talking point. You have someone in your backyard, you can say, hey, do you know that there's over 300 native species of bee in Iowa? And, you know, some of them are stem nesting, but others are ground nesting. So it's important that we leave kind of these open spaces, leave some places untilled so that they've got a place to nest.
And I read an article online the other day saying that there was a concern that actually these bee hotels or pollinator hotels might even spread disease because you're drawing many different species into this environment. Any concerns about that? Could they actually be doing harm?
I don't know if I would say doing harm, but I would say that it's one of those situations where your heart's in the right place, but it might not be the best option for the bees. There are concerns that, yes, over time, if you're using the same nest with the same holes and not cleaning it out, different bacteria or fungi can build up in there, different diseases can build up in there, which is why often a lot of people, if they have the straws or the tubes, what they can do is roll up pieces of like parchment paper and put it in there. So the hole is still wide, but at the end of the year when the bee's done using it, they can pull that parchment paper out. And it's sort of like it had a lining in it all year around. That's something that people commonly do. With a lot of mason bees, sometimes they sell commercially, mason and leafcutter bees. You can actually open up the tubes, the nest that they're nesting in, and pull out the little capsules that that are the pupating bees. And you can take them and put them in your refrigerator and then release them at a later date. And that way you're avoiding any diseases that could encroach on them, any sort of pests or predators that might reach them as well.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Kathleen is on the line in North Liberty. The number to call, 866-780-9100. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, do native pollinators have varroa mites?
Oh, yeah. That's
do varroa mites live on or parasitize native pollinators?
So for those who don't know, varroa mite, which is probably one of the greatest challenges for honeybees, is it's a small mite and it's a parasite that lives inside the hives. It's called Varroa destructor, and we use European honeybees in the United States. The varroa mite originally came from Asian honeybees, but at some point in the late 80s, it jumped species and was able to feed on European honeybees, and it's just been a huge problem. Varroa mite not only sucks on the blood and the fat, or the hemolymph and the fat of the bees, but as it's doing that, it also can jump from bee to bee and spread different diseases. Viruses, like deformed wing virus, for example, where a bee is born with deformed wings and can't be a productive member of the hive. So in my research, I've seen that it seems more species specific, but since we've seen it jump from the Asian honeybee to the European honeybee, it's something I'm sure that people need to keep an eye on. But the varroa mite, as far as I know, is not a huge problem for bumblebees, for example. Although, that said, in some of my colleagues' analyses of bumblebees for viruses, they have found honeybee viruses, trace amounts of honeybee viruses that don't affect the bumblebees in bumblebees. So it's something that people are cognizant of, but right now that's not something that we're worried about.
All right, Kathleen, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. We've got a couple of lines open for your questions right now. And here is a question from Tom in Waterloo. The oregano plant in my garden, when in bloom, attracts many more pollinators to the tiny white flowers than the other nearby blooming mints, bee balm, or mixed flowers. The diversity and numbers of pollinators on this one plant, which is the size of a hula hoop, is incredible. The plant blooms for a long time and attracts pollinators for the duration. Why are more pollinators attracted to this plant than the others in the garden? Anybody?
There's really no answer to that.
All right. It's a fun observation, though.
It is. They do like certain types of oregano, and other plants they totally ignore. So it's basically the food, the scent, or something there.
All right. Maybe our native pollinators are Italian as well.
there are Italian varieties of honeybees. Absolutely.
All right. Here is a question from Alex in Cedar Rapids. When would be the best time and way to transplant or start from seed Jack in the Pulpit?
Jack in the Pulpit. Well, one way to start those would be to collect the seeds. After flowering, the plant produces a cluster of these dark green berry-like fruit. And eventually they turn a bright orangey red, typically in late summer. And then at that point, you can remove the actual fruit. And I think there are two or three seeds per berry. And you can squeeze those out and plant those in the ground in the fall. And hopefully they'll germinate. Basically, that plant likes a moist soil. And so a good moist to wet soil, put it there. And some of those should germinate?
I have a lot of experience with this, actually. When I first moved to my house in Iowa City in 19 years ago, I actually did what Richard just described, and I planted probably 10, 15 seeds. I probably have 30 to 50 plants now. It's really spread on its own. Mm-hmm. It's a native, beautiful native plant. That flower is really neat early in the spring, and then you have that food source late summer, early fall for a lot of different animals. And I have plants now that I planted 19 years ago that are 3 to 4 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
I mean, so as they develop their perennial, they keep coming back each year, and they're a very nice shade plant, very good native shade plant. So if you have a backyard with some trees on a hillside, and all I did is exactly what Richard said, and I took those seeds and I just put them under the surface just a little bit, just kind of rubbed them in and then covered them up. And the next spring, I probably had 5 or 10 come up, and they've gone from there.
Wow. All right. Next question. This one's for you, Mark. This is from Steve in Mason City. Can long dead oaks be felled without much risk of spreading beetle vectors of disease?
So if it's I'm assuming long dead is in a large dead. Oh, long dead.
Long
okay.
dead.
So it's been dead for a number
a while.
Of years. Yeah. Is the big thing with that, Steve, is as long as that tree, when it goes down and when you're working, you don't damage any residual oaks, live oaks in the area, you're fine. So the big thing with oak wilt and the big concerns there, usually that after a year, so if a tree dies this summer, next year, if that tree's still standing dead at the end of the summer, a dead tree like that is not going to be contagious and not going to be a problem. Even using the wood, you're not going to attract the beetles that actually carry the disease because that tree will no longer produce fungal mats. So if it's been dead for numerous years, as long as they can get that down without damaging live oaks in the area, they can take it down now.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Phil is on the line in West Branch. Hi, Phil.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What's your question?
Hi, yeah, so I'm growing some coneflowers, and I have a little bit of yellowing on the bottom of the leaves, and they kind of curl up a little bit, and I was curious if that was something that was like a mildew or fungus, or if it was more of like a nutrient deficiency. Some of the ones that got a little bit more advanced, what makes me think it's a fungus is that some of them have kind of curled up all the way back, and a couple of them have lost.
Okay, so is this a purple coneflower or an orange coneflower?
They're the yellow coneflowers.
Okay. It's hard to say on the phone. What you might want to do is possibly take some nice digital photos, some nice close-ups, and send those to our plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State. Their email address is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu.
Okay.
All right, Phil, thanks a lot for the call, and good luck with that. Next up, we've got Mark in Manson. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question goes back to the issue of use of pesticides on lawns. I'm out and about every day. I'm a letter carrier for the United States Postal Service, and I see lots and lots of those pesticide flags planted on people's lawns, you know, alerting people that pesticides have been used. And I'm wondering what the panel thinks we can do to raise the level of awareness among people so that they realize that there's a real emergency, a real crisis here in the loss of pollinator and insect species.
Mark, thanks for bringing that up. I know that's people have had a lot of conversations about that. Randall, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. So I've been in Iowa almost 2 years, and one thing I can say is that Iowans love a manicured, clean-looking lawn. They love that even around their fields, there's everything just looks, it's mowed, and it looks beautiful. I would challenge that perspective on what beautiful is. So I think that one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now is that people do want to promote pollinator habitat. But then you take them to a prairie and they think, that just looks like a mess. that looks like a bunch of weeds. That doesn't, it just doesn't look that like a nice manicured lawn. So I try to talk to people and some other folks here at Iowa State University, for example, from the Monarch Consortium, talk to folks about changing their perspective on what they see as beautiful. Maybe a prairie looks a little bit disorderly, but you get all these flowers throughout the year. So I guess it's a conversation about what is the best kind of habitat for bees, and where can we walk that line between what we find that looks pretty in our yards or on our properties, and what's going to be beneficial for the bees.
And there are a number of groups in Iowa right now that are promoting diversity in our lawns. That seems to be a growing movement, but we need to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, entomologist Randall Cass from Iowa State University Extension, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, and Iowa State University Extension Entomologist Randall Cass, who's an expert on honeybees, native bees, and other pollinators. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question from Emily in State Center. I have an apple tree I neglected to trim last winter. There are very large suckers coming from the rootstock. Is it okay for me to cut them back?
Yes, absolutely.
And cutting them back is all she
back
should do,
to
though,
the
right?
Back to the point of origin, yes.
All right, and don't put anything on them.
Right.
Okay.
Don't need to.
Great. This is from Jordan. It's a difficult one. He says, what options do I have to keep my neighbors from spraying their lawns? Why are there city ordinances against weeds but not against pesticides?
You could have a conversation with them, but beyond that, I don't think you have any legal recourse?
Here's a question from Kevin. He says, we live in a 25-year-old subdivision with a nice wide cul-de-sac and green space. We're down from 8 to 5 trees lining the perimeter of the green space. I'm going to approach the association about replanting those 3, looking at white pines and locust based on your past conversations. How far from the street or curb should we plant to maximize our green space but keep the mature trees from encroaching on the street?
So I probably next or close to the street, I probably wouldn't use white pine. That's usually not a good boulevard or parking type tree, especially if there's driveways. If you're coming out and you have an evergreen, they tend to have branches all the way down, so there could be some visuals. If it was in an area away, that may be okay. But there's a lot of different shade trees that they could use. We've talked about the publication alternatives to maple that the DNR has. There's a good list on iowatreepest.com, that alternatives to ash that Dr. Isles put together. But basically, did he say that area was 10 feet wide?
He didn't really say that.
Okay.
So it's surrounding a green space. So I think that he's wondering how close to the perimeter he should get.
As in the neighbor's property and stuff like that, we're probably, you're looking at me like, okay.
I don't
so
know.
Here's
That's
the deal.
All I got.
So if you're planting a shade tree, here's what we want to look at. If you're planting a shade tree, most shade trees, your oaks, your locusts and stuff like that, could have spreads of 35 to 55 feet. So if there's going to be boundary issues, they should be thinking of planting trees probably 35 to 40 feet from those boundaries, or 25 to 40 feet to think about, basically think about what the diameter of that tree is going to be and then give that much room. And I probably would add another 5 or 10 feet, because if they say that tree is going to have a 40-foot spread, it's going to have a 50-foot spread, you know, in the right conditions. And we want to think long term.
Right.
So basically think about what the ultimate spread of that tree is going to be and then basically cut it in half and then add another 5 to 10 feet.
All right.
That would be my answer.
Let's go back to the phones. Carolyn's on the line in Sac City. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
Talking about bur oak trees, I'm having them treated with a fungicide for bur oak blight. And my question is, will the fungicide harm the pollinators and indirectly the birds that feed on the pollinators? I'm trying to save the trees, but are there other consequences?
Well, I can talk, maybe Randall, most fungicides, and you may go to this, Randall, but shouldn't have an issue with pollinators. If we were using an insecticide, that would be a different situation. But in the case of a fungicide, do you know of any potential issues, Randall?
Yeah, it's actually sort of an emerging topic in some bee research that's happening right now. So, you know, in the microscopic world, there are all sorts of relationships that we don't realize are happening. And it turns out that honeybees have a symbiotic relationship with different types of fungi. And so fungicide could, in the same way that we have, you know, beneficial bacteria in our guts, honeybees are living in their hives with this beneficial fungi. So if they do bring back this fungicide residue back to their hive, it could be hurting this organism that they have a beneficial relationship with. And it's something that it's sort of an emerging area of research, and I don't feel well rehearsed enough with it to talk that much about it. But it could be a concern, not for killing bees, but perhaps having sort of this negative sublethal effect.
Could that fungicide actually be carried in the flower though, like the insecticides are? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
So to Carolyn's question, what should she be thinking about right now? What's your take?
I would say just proceed with caution. Be aware of the different pollinators that are around where you would want to use the fungicide. And maybe try to do a little bit of homework to see if the type that you're using could have any potential risks.
In this particular one, Randall, that they use is actually injected into the trees for bur oak blight.
It is injected right into the vascular system of the tree.
That's a little out of my area.
All right. So, Mark, what's your take?
I would continue to look at treating, but as Randall kind of said, look at research and actually that particular chemical. Find out which chemical they're going to use. And then do a little more research to see if there's any information out there on potential issues.
All right, Carolyn.
But that's good that he mentioned that because that's good information.
And Carolyn, thanks for your call. And Mark, I know we've talked in the past about concerns with people trying to save their ash trees and possible negative consequences of the kinds of chemicals that are used to treat an ash tree too. So, I mean, it's something that we need to think about.
Definitely be aware of, yeah.
It's not just... Everything's
but it's
interconnected.
Good to know from their research that there could be some connections there.
All right. Here is a question from Carol. I have a question about mulching. I have a number of old trees on my easement, and I would like to mulch all along the easement. These old trees have visible roots above the ground. How close to these roots can I mulch?
You can cover them. That should be no issue. I would put on no more than 3 inches around the trees, but you can actually cover the roots. That should not be an issue. You wouldn't cover those with soil, but you can cover them with mulch.
And don't mound the mulch up against the trunk. So pull it a few inches away from the trunk itself and don't create mounds or volcanoes that we see a lot of times because that mulch will become soil over time. So you do want to – and the thing to remember is those exposed roots will continue to get bigger in diameter. So they may have to, over time – those roots may become exposed again. So there may be more mulch that needs to be added over time. So it's not a one and done. But if you go those thinner layers, then it won't be as detrimental.
All right. And it sounds like you can save yourself a lot of mowing
yes.
in this situation. That's fantastic.
Keeps the mower away from the trunk, too.
Right. Okay. Here's a question from Patricia on the line in Waverly. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I am a great fan of Port Friday, but my only serious complaint ever is that so frequently the name of the plant you're talking about is mentioned once at the beginning, and then I don't know what you're talking about. And I would like to know, before I ask my other question, what plant you were talking about, native berry plant that would be very good to propagate. I'm trying to guess what that would be.
Oh, Jack in the Pulpit?
Yeah, oh, okay. That
Jack
was
in
my
the
guess.
Pulpit.
Okay.
That's
okay,
a,
thank you much.
That's a native woodland plant, and you can actually buy it at garden centers.
Oh, I have plenty on my property. I love them. My mother was a great wildflower gardener as I was growing up. And one of the things that she had in our yard that I very seldom see, although I have found one in town, is the wahoo. To me, that was the most beautiful, magical tree. And I'm wondering, is there any way that with the person that I know that has a living wahoo, is there any way I could propagate my own from that?
You should be able
from
to take
the
some
berries or.
I think you should be able to take some cuttings on that. What I would do would be go out right about now, sometime in the next couple of weeks, and take cuttings of the new growth, about 4 to 6 inches in length, and bring it home or bring it inside, and then pinch off the leaves on the lower half of the cutting, and then buy a rooting hormone that you can buy at a garden center, dip the cut end in that material, and then you're going to need to root it either in coarse sand or perlite. So you could use like a big pot, fill that with your perlite or coarse sand, water it in nicely, make a hole with your finger in the actual perlite or sand, stick the cutting in there, then water again, and then you could put like 3 or 4 in a pot. And then once you've done that, I would take some small stakes, put those just inside the rim of the container, then put a clear plastic bag over everything, the pot and the cuttings, making kind of a mini greenhouse, and then put it in bright light, And if everything goes good, goes right, it should root, those cuttings should root in 6 to 8 weeks.
We tried that last year with everything except for the plastic bag, and it did not work.
Because when you have those cuttings, those leaves still lose moisture. And they have no root system to absorb water. So initially, when they lose water, they're going to wilt and they're going to die. But that mini greenhouse keeps it nice and moist inside. And so that gives them a chance to root before they actually die.
All right, Patricia, thanks a lot. And for those of us who don't know what a wahoo is, can Mark, you want to describe it for us?
Yes, it's actually a native euonymus. So when we always talk about burning bush, I was going to congratulate Patricia on growing a native plant because the alternative burning bush that most people plant is actually becoming very invasive. It's a non-native that becomes very invasive in our woodlands. So we're used to that beautiful pink-red fall color that that burning bush provides, and wahoo will provide that also. But it's more, it doesn't get sheared and shaped like the burning bush does, so it's a more open, kind of, I would call it a small tree, larger shrub. But go with the native on that case. Great choice, Patricia.
All right. Well, and a lot of people experienced winter kill on their burning bushes. Maybe this
they
is
did.
The perfect
Correct.
Opportunity and to make a change.
The other thing is it's kind of a woodland edge. It has some shade tolerance. So if you have a backyard or an area that has a little bit of shade and stuff, it's a good alternative plant.
All right. Next up, let's go to Joe in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, guys. I'm actually on the road here, so I'll take my call, my answer offline here. But the last few years, we've planted winter squash. We love Hubbard squash and some of the large winter squash just to, grow. And basically, we then freeze some of it and use it in our cooking throughout the year. The last 3 or 4 years, the squash borers and ants, mostly squash borers, just decimated our crop. And again, this is just an acreage planting. I mean, not a commercial grower or anything. Just wondering what kind of cultural practices and what kind of things you might recommend to kind of deal with that. I know with the winter, some of the pests are coming out at slightly different times this year with the cool spring that we've had. But I'm just kind of disappointed that I'd like to try something different, see if we can do a little better. So and I'll take my answer offline here.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, they typically start showing up in June, so it might be a little bit later than normal, but one way to control that would be to apply an insecticide basically around the bottom of the vine, because that's where they basically, the females lay their eggs, and then the eggs hatch, and then the larvae basically tunnel into the stem. So if you apply an insecticide at the base, beginning probably this week or so, that would hopefully prevent that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Jake in Cedar Falls. Hi, Jake.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question about hostas. My wife plants a lot of varieties of hostas in our front of our house, and one of them has what looks like something eating it, and it's a bunch of tiny circles on the leaves, but it doesn't eat all the way through the leaf. It just leaves it translucent looking, and she didn't know. She was wondering if it was a fungus or a bug or anything we could do about it.
Boy, it's hard to say on the radio what that would be. There is a leaf miner, but I don't think that's what it is. If it's a leaf miner, you would see kind of feces inside the actual leaf and maybe the actual insect. It might be some type of fungal disease, possibly, where the leaf is kind of dried up and turned kind of translucent. That's a possibility, too.
You don't think it's slugs?
Slugs would have actual holes, and they would be kind of irregular in size.
These are perfect circles.
But the actual leaf is missing, or parts of the leaf are missing?
No, it's a perfectly fine leaf. It's just they're perfect circles, and they're all over in, like, I'd say probably about the size of a 50-cent piece.
Okay.
There's groups of them clustered together like that, and they're just they're translucent. There's no holes all the way through it.
So, it's not slugs because they would eat holes right through it. So it's not those. It's not a cutworm. I would look at the holes very carefully and see if you do see feces inside. They would be black in color. If not, I'm assuming it may be some type of fungal disease, and you may want to send a sample to the plant diagnostic clinic.
Okay. Yeah. All right, and that's just at the Iowa State Extension?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thanks a lot for your call, Jake. And one more call. Susanna's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Susanna.
Hi. When the first blossoms come on my comfrey and everything, I just let them go because I figure that way I'm giving to all the bees and different things instead of just having it be the end of the season when things are going to seed. And I was just wondering if there was a certain kind of regime for that kind of thing to just encourage more bees instead of trying to just pinch things off and not letting things blossom with herbs and things. Is that something that people do that way?
Well, if you did have some plants, they typically will produce additional flowers. Many plants will, especially the annual plants. The perennial plants typically won't, but if you have a plant, if it's done blooming, you can pinch it off, and many annual plants will then maybe set additional flowers.
All right. Well, Susanna, thank you for your call, and we are out of time. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Randall Cass, thank you.
Thank you.
Randall Cass, entomologist with Iowa State University Extension, and Mark Vitosh, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, and of course, we'll be back next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. And I want to take just a couple of seconds to say that we have a difficult goodbye to say today. Our producer, Emily Woodbury, this is her last day. She's been with us for the last 7 years, her first job out of college, and she started out as a hungry young producer ready to learn everything she could. And she did. She's been an exceptional producer for us, an award-winning, detail-oriented, creative, and risk-taking producer for us for 7 years. And we will miss her so much. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.